You know, there's a lot of really exciting work happening to increase our access to biofuels. And some of that cutting-edge work is going on right at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And something we're going to be talking about next, because raising crops for bioenergy, it's good for the earth in the long run. Still doesn't mean that we can just go ahead and raise those crops without thinking about their impacts. And so we're going to talk about that today, a little bit about bioengineering and a little bit about the importance of biodiversity with our two guests. John Greenler has been with us many times. John directs education and outreach programs for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And great to have you back.
Thank you, Larry.
Love to have you with us. And Tim Meehan is an associate scientist in the Department of Entomology at the UW-Madison and with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center here at UW-Madison. And Tim, thank you for spending time with us today, too. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the invite.
Appreciate it very much. Let's talk about biodiversity. Now, that term, I heard that term a lot, and it might not hurt to define that. John, you want to give it a shot first?
Well, actually, I might just pass it over to my entomology and
okay.
Ecologist who really spends his days thinking about this. So, Tim, I don't know if you want to start out or...
Yeah, it's kind of a broad term. But usually when people talk about biodiversity, they're talking about the variety of different species out there. But you can also think of biodiversity in terms of within a species, there's also a certain amount of genetic diversity. So,
okay,
those are basically the number of species and within that species, how much variation is there in terms of their genetics.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it's about plants and it's about animals and, you know, some of the most important biodiversity, you know, might be those animals that we don't even really see when we drive by a field or a wooded area, whatever, the insects, et cetera. Yeah. Even the microbes are really important when we consider these biodiversity issues.
Huh.
Yeah, all these things they're out there doing their thing and providing us with a lot of services that we kind of take for granted a lot of the times.
So when I'm thinking about insects and within a species of insects, there's quite a fair amount of biodiversity. Is there an example, or could you give us an example or two?
Yeah, so, you know, within any particular species, you're going to have a wide range of body sizes or a wide range of, structure and color and physiology and, you know, all that is sort of represents, genetic diversity within that species.
So, yeah, I guess you only have to think about butterflies.
Yeah.
That's probably as good an example as we have of a great diversity.
Yeah, there's a diversity of species, and then within each species, there's a lot of variety. Not every butterfly looks exactly the same. You know, if you really study it, then there's a lot of variation. Yeah.
And that variation can really change quite rapidly because you can have, you know, multiple generations in 1 year, in one growing season. Yeah. You know, insects may have 5 or 6, you know, life cycles going on. So things can happen very quickly when you're working with insects in terms of that diversity and corresponding kind of evolutionary phenomena as well.
And then that affects, in some ways, the overall diversity that we have in nature.
Yeah, you can think of diversity both within a species and across species as like an insurance policy. So if we lived in a completely stable environment where nothing ever changed, then there would be a certain best way to be. But the fact is we live in a world where things are changing all the time. So sometimes it might be beneficial to be big, or sometimes it might be beneficial to be small, depending on temperature or the kind of predators that are around. You have a dry year and, you know, you want to be really efficient at using water, and you have a wet mm-hmm. year and, you know, you want to be a really fast grower. So there's all sorts of strategies, and that those strategies for getting along are dependent upon the environment that you're in at the moment. And so having a lot of variety and strategies in your population or across your community, it just gives you more, you know, a bigger bag of tricks, so to speak, when nature throws you curveballs.
And I think we, you know, years ago we had a lot of that diversity, and I'm just saying in terms of agriculture right now. And then in some ways we kind of got away from that, where mm-hmm. we, you know, farms that 8,000 acres of corn, and every year after corn or whatever crop, that's one example. But I mean, we've kind of we had at least at that level not a whole lot of diversity, and I think that might be changing a bit. Maybe not.
Yeah, if you look at sort of trends over the last 150 years or so, 150 years ago, people were farming with horses, and so they're limited in the way that they could affect the land and how much land they could really cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, things have gotten more mechanized. Now it's easier to have much larger fields. It's easier to farm basically much larger tracts of a homogeneous type of plant.
Does it, and just following up with that then, does it make a difference, if you're thinking about biodiversity, does it make a whole lot of difference if we're talking about an individual field or a woodlot? Or?
So there's sort of, you can think of diversity at a couple of different levels. When you're looking down at a map, right, you can look at a particular field and think about the diversity within a field. Like a particular field might have a lot of beneficial insects or a few beneficial insects, and that a lot of times is determined by how much plant diversity is there. If there's a lot of plant diversity, if there's plenty of resources for a wide variety of insects, for example, then there you'd expect a lot of insect diversity or animal diversity in general. If you are in that same field and that field is very homogenous, it's just one plant species, then you're going to expect a much lower diversity of animals. And then also you can zoom out sort of at a much larger scale, and you can see the landscape and say, well, when you have a whole bunch of different types of patches, you're going to have a whole different whole bunch of different types of animal species running around. But when you have just maybe a couple of different habitat types out in the landscape, then you just can have at the landscape scale a lot fewer animal species, a lot less variety.
Yeah.
You really see that in Wisconsin. I mean, Chloe, so many of us, you fly in out of Madison, you look down at our agricultural landscape, and there's a real patchy nature to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, there are a lot of benefits to that as compared to, if we're over Nebraska or something. I think the farmers can really benefit from that landscape scale diversity. It brings a lot of, it also provides an aesthetic in terms of, how we as humans kind of appreciate the landscape as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. We were just last Friday, I was talking with Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery, and one of the topics we got on was just, he was talking about one of his own prairies and started and, grew this prairie and the change in the insects and the birds and the animals that now are there compared, just as smorgasbord compared to what it was.
Right. And when you're talking, clearly Neil's an expert in that area of ecological restoration, of kind of, trying to diversify our landscape. And Wisconsin, once again, has a great history of that, starting out with Adel Leopold at the Arboretum. But, these things take time, but they bring a lot of benefits. And, in fact, we can talk more about this as we go forward. But, there are elements of what we're looking forward to in terms of perennial biofuel crops that really have aspects that are essentially restoring our native ecology, using native species, looking at the possibility of multiple species that are all natives that are prairie based, et cetera. And how can we really be benefiting from those types of opportunities? So I'm trying to really understand how much diversity do we need in the plant species, for example, to get the insects and all the other dimensions that are so important in terms of biodiversity.
So it may be possible to have a biodiversity in the crops that you grow, you're saying, and still have enough production and, get a decent production out of it.
That's what we're looking for, yeah. We're looking for win-win situations where we get productive energy crops, and we also start to bring back some of that variety in the landscape.
Yeah, that's so, and that's kind of what you're zeroing in on a little bit, Tim Meehan?
Yep.
Well, I'm telling you what, we've got I haven't even given the number for people to call in, which is Judah saying, what the heck are you doing over in there? So let me give that number. 1-800, yeah, I get blabbing away here, and I should have been telling people, they can join in too if you want to join in.
Please.
You can. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page. You can post a question, a comment, even a photo there if you want to. And the Facebook page is at the Larry Mueller Show. And our guests today, John Greenler and Tim Meehan, are going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. So you stay with us. You've probably heard that term banana republic. It refers to a country whose economy is based on one product, not a very reliable economic model, to say the least. And not good for the environment either. All we have to look at is the Dust Bowl to sort of that devastated the Plain States. The native grasses that held the soil in place were ripped out to plant acre upon acre of one crop, which is probably wheat, I think. It had some disastrous results. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. John Greenler of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center with us, as is Tim Meehan from the UW Department of Entomology, also works in the GLBRC area, talking about biodiversity today. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org. We'll be back right after the news. There's a lot of really exciting work happening to increase our access to biofuel. Some of that cutting-edge work happening here at the UW-Madison. Larry Mueller here. Tell you what, there are some crops that are being researched right now that will not only be great for bioenergy, but will also be great for building diversity, crop diversity. And that's something, biodiversity is something that we really need in this world and probably and for certain ought to be working to improve and increase the amount of biodiversity that we have. John Greenler is Director of Education and Outreach Programs for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And John, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Tim Meehan, PhD and Associate Scientist in the Department of Entomology with the center as well. And Tim, thanks for spending time with us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And we have questions. You have questions. Maybe do you think that biodiversity is a good idea? Do you have fields and natural areas around you that you might have questions about in the area of biodiversity? Maybe you are trying to increase your support of biodiversity on the land that you live on or occupy. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org. We would love to hear from you. Judy in Door County has been waiting quite a while, so let's go there. Judy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question, and I don't know if you're able to assist me with this or not, but I'm about to plant a pasture. I graze sheep at this time, and I'm, of course, surrounded by a bunch of corn farmers. What I would like to do is put in pasture, try to adhere to native Wisconsin grasses, if that's possible, something still that would be adequate for grazing my animals on. And I don't know if that's something that you can assist me with or direct me so that I can achieve that biodiversity that you're talking about and still have healthy animals in the meantime.
Yeah. Well, John, you want to take a stab at least where she could go for more information?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, I think you're on a really good and very interesting track. You know, I know, you know, when you get more into the Western states, there's a lot of work along this line. You know, largely looking at cattle and bison and whatnot, and you know, the Nature Conservancy is even involved in a number of projects looking at how to support grazing, but also also kind of promote the biodiversity and native vegetation. And there's definitely a lot of work in that domain that has been quite successful. Mainly, in that case, we're looking at short grass prairie as compared to tall grass prairie. I mean, which is, you know, what we're looking at in this area. What I don't know is how sheep would fit in with the vegetation of a tall grass prairie. You know, it's interesting. We were talking about Neil DeBall at Prairie Nursery just a few minutes ago. And, you know, I think one place to start at least would be to contact Prairie Nursery and see if, you know, what they might know. I mean, they're a good, at least one good source of seed, and they might have some idea of what type of prairie species might be a good opportunity. You might be looking at more, a little bit of a compromise. It wouldn't surprise me if some of the short grass prairie species might be a little bit more appropriate for sheep grazing. But my guess is they could allow you to hone in on some of those details and maybe even provide you with some seed mix as well. So,
yeah, I think Neil probably would have some good ideas. Yeah.
Thanks. I apologize. I tuned in late. Could you tell me the name of the nursery again?
It's Prairie Nursery. And it's
online?
Yeah, you'll find it at prairienursery.com, I think.
Just Google Prairie Nursery. Yep.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. It's right here in Wisconsin, across the state from you, just west of you, quite a ways west of Door County. But frankly, Prairie Nursery, they go all, as do many nurseries. They go all over the state, frankly, all over the country. So, and Patty in Milwaukee, hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good afternoon. I got a question. I've been living in the downtown area of Milwaukee for over 23 years. I have a big plot of land that I have rejuvenated and put in all sorts of plants that service birds and insect population. Now, I've noticed that I'm not seeing much in monarch or bee. Is anything being done to try to figure out why these two families are dying off so rapidly? Because it's concerning me. I'm not getting the pollinizing process I need for my flowers to bloom and encourage, you know, wildlife in.
Okay, that's something else we were talking about a little bit off air. And if you've got a diverse, John, if she has some diversity there, she's going to have other than honeybees.
Well, see, it's a little tricky because, the honeybee that, is kind of the iconic bee that we think of, which is, fairly large, whatever, a half an inch or so in length. I mean, larger when you get into the queens or the drones. But, a lot of the solitary bees, which are the native bees and are really very productive in terms of pollination, they can be very, very small, almost imperceptible. And so, it can be very tricky to really know what's out there. And it might be that you have the taxonomic expertise to do that. But I know for myself, I really have to really focus, how I'm looking to really begin to see those solitary bees as compared to, the honeybee, which is, what we think of. So,
and Tim, when we were talking a little bit about, for example, cranberry growers, as we talk about biodiversity here, and I know Neil DeBull was working with cranberry growers on having strips of prairie in between the crops.
This is a strategy that people are experimenting with, is to put strips or buffers around your fields or whatever that have a fair amount of diversity in them, especially a bunch of floral, flower resources, and that tends to attract bees into the area. A lot of them, some of them are honeybees, but like John said, a lot of these would be the native bees that we don't pay attention to a lot of the times, but that still do a great service to us. And those types of strips are beneficial because they provide a food source for bees, but they also provide an undisturbed habitat for them to nest in. So, because a lot of times people think of a beehive and they think of this big gray thing that's, up in a tree. It's really a wasp nest. Beehives, most bees don't actually live in hives. They're solitary. And they either lay their eggs in small tunnels in the ground or they lay them in the pith of a stem. So there's a lot of grass-nesting bees, a lot of ground-nesting bees. And these bees really do much better when there's some sort of undisturbed habitat around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
providing that refuge for the insects is really important, as well as kind of food for the pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I just want to address... is it Patty that asked the question?
Yeah, Patty.
Yeah, so Patty, you also asked about, are people concerned about monarchs and and honeybees, and are they paying attention to their declines? And that's certainly a lot. There's certainly a lot of work being done on that. People are concerned about monarchs for a lot of reasons. They're kind of a flagship species for butterflies. They have an amazing natural history where they, you know, they migrate to these places in central Mexico, and so they're pretty amazing critters. There's been a lot of work trying to understand their population dynamics and whether or not they're increasing or decreasing and why. With the bees, you know, people are concerned about bee populations as well, honeybees in particular. Honeybees are one of our big pollinators. You know, I said the native bees do a lot of pollinating, but the honeybees are managed for that, and there's tractor-trailer loads of them being trucked around the country all the time so that they can pollinate crops. And so, yeah, the decline in honeybees is definitely a big issue. You know, it's partly related to parasites like mites. It's partly related to poor health that might be brought on by a combination of things like exposure to insecticides or changing climatic conditions or
stress from getting moved all over the country.
Stress from, being tractor trailer, exactly. So there's all sorts of things that might be affecting them, and it's an issue that came up in the news, you know, a couple of years ago, and it's died down a little bit, but the problem is still there, and people are still wrestling with what the deal is.
Just a couple quick add-ins here. If you're interested in monarchs, a way that you can become involved in the Citizen Science Project, go online and check out Project Monarch Watch. Really exceptional organization to really try and get everybody involved in studying what's happening with these monarch populations. And then a little bit more on the fun side, if you're a reader, there's a new book out by Barbara Kingsolver, who's been writing novels for years, a book called Flight Behaviors, which you know, the monarchs are probably the main character in the book, and it's really a wonderful read. So if you're into monarchs, Flight Behaviors, I recommend it.
We'll have to get a copy of that book and get Barbara on the phone, on the show. we can do that. Denny and Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, I'm an amateur honeybee raiser, and I'm well aware of the losses we're incurring. It's hard to winter them over anymore, but that's not what I called about. I also am a native bee researcher, and I'm in fact doing that right now, and we have a group through Beaver Creek Reserve here. There's three of us that we collect native bees on restored prairies by Eau Claire. And I have over 500 bees from this last season that we collect. We collect them roughly once a month, and then I identify them to species. And so what we're trying to do is establish a baseline of presence and along with a floral presence on these restored prairies to determine in future research if there's a decline in the native bees. Because if we lose those, we're really lost.
Yeah,
that's great to hear. It's great to hear.
There is this research being done because I'm doing it.
Boy, that is a labor of love. Thank you so much.
Oh, it really, I'm spending full time on, I'm retired, and so I'm a citizen scientist, and I'm devoting full time to this project, so.
That's wonderful.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's great to hear, and it's hard to emphasize enough the importance of the kind of stuff that you're doing. A lot of times the research that we do, you know, at the university, we is for as much resources as we have, we're still limited in terms of the places where we can be at one time. You know, we can only be in so many places at one time, and all research takes a lot of resources. And so when we have folks out there like yourself collecting data, these data sources can be combined, and we can do large scale analyses about what's affecting bees and what bee populations are doing. So it's fantastic to hear that you're doing this type of thing.
I do a lot of work with Sam Droege out at the USGS in Beltsville, Maryland.
Oh, yeah.
It's when you start in a taxonomy of bees, it's tough.
It is tough, definitely. There's some folks in the lab where I work on campus here at UW that are trying to work out a new way of identifying bees by taking pictures of their wings and using computer algorithms that, you know, the types of things that do retinal scans and these types
of
things. Oh, and they're trying to, you know, to take a picture of a wing and look at that wing and based on the wing venation patterns, figure out what species it is. And they're making some progress. I think they're at the species level, they're about 85% accurate right now. So
wow.
Yeah.
I'm aware of it. I just didn't know exactly where they were. I'm waiting for that.
I bet you are, yeah. Denny. Well, thanks a lot for calling, and thanks for your good work. That's really wonderful, the work that you're doing there. You know, in order to get, you know, he's talking about the native bees here, and we one of the things we started to talk about was the crops and biodiversity, and the biodiverse crops are going to bring in diversity in the bees and the other insects. What crops do or could promote biodiversity? Tim, Ian, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I think a lot of the conversation, and some of the callers have alluded to this, there's a handful of things that that sort of drive biodiversity within a patch, within a field. And like we said, it has to do with the diversity of the plants and whatnot. But then it also depends on the landscape that patch is embedded in. So if it's in a diverse landscape, a lot of habitat types, then you're going to have more species in your area. As far as biofuel crops go, there's this trade-off that we have to deal with. You know, we want things to be as productive as possible, so that we don't have to use a lot of land to produce right. bioenergy. But then we also want it to potentially have a bunch of diversity in there. So you know, at the GLBRC, in our group, we're trying to figure out, well, just how many species do you need to start bringing in this diversity? And it's kind of too soon to say, to give an exact number, and that exact number is going to be dependent on where you live. But just to give you a ballpark idea, if you've got a bioenergy crop that's got, say, one species in it, you're going to have relatively low, well, it depends. If it's a crop that has one species in it and it's an annual crop and it gets disturbed a lot, then you're going to have relatively low animal diversity in that.
So disturbed being like plowed or
plowed, replanted, harvested, you know, herbicide, insecticide, whatever. So if you're a single species and a lot of disturbance, you're going to have relatively little animal diversity there.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a single species but it's perennial crop, like say a pure switchgrass stand, mm-hmm. you're going to have considerably more because even though it's one species, it's not disturbed nearly as much. So you're going to provide, you know,
a home kind of
a home, exactly. So for these ground nesting bees, for example. Now, as you start to add species, you get up to 5 to 10 species. You're going to continue to increase the diversity in that field because now you've got, you know, less disturbance. Plus, you've got more plant diversity, which gives a wider variety of resources for a wider variety of animals. Mm-hmm. Once you get up to about, let's say, somewhere between 10 and 20 species in your mix. It really starts to plateau where you don't see quite as much of a, you know, it's a diminishing returns kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see quite as much of a response in the animal community. So we're hoping that we can find some place in that spectrum of one mm-hmm. to 20 different species where we're balancing those different needs of providing biodiversity habitat, but also, you know, we can really refine the really super productive crops, you know, right. So it might be a matter of having a couple of very productive energy crops mixed in with a bunch of other things that are going to service biodiversity.
Yeah. So how do we get a good yield of biomass?
Yeah.
But then also the other thing which is interesting is not all plants are created the same in terms of actually trying to convert that fibrous material into a liquid fuel. And so there's some very interesting research that we're embarking on to say, you know, we need these kinds of characteristics from different species, you know, which ones will provide those biodiverse characteristics but still be amiable to conversion into a fuel as well. So
mm-hmm.
it's a very interesting collaborative effort, you know, where we have chemists working with ecologists trying to figure mm-hmm. out how to maintain and build our landscape and be able to make a sustainable fuel at the same time.
No, so, but that's in the back of the minds of your minds as you work on do all this work.
Exactly.
Absolutely. It's one of the fun parts about working in the center, actually, is that we get together several times during the year, and we talk to the people that are doing plant breeding and plant genetics and the folks that are doing the conversion. And, you know, we talk to the engineers and say, well, how much grass biomass do we need as opposed to flowering plant biomass? And they can give us a rough number based on what they know about engineering. And it's really neat to be able to speed the process along by having this dialogue.
Well, it's kind of the value of a center, I guess, because you're bringing in all these different viewpoints.
Thank you, Larry. That's exactly right. That interdisciplinarity, that, you know, that synergism that we can get by bringing researchers in from very different areas. It's fun.
Yeah. Mike and we just lost Mike in Madison. I was going to go to him. Bill in Marshfield. Hi. Thank you for calling. Bill, I guess, did we lose Bill, too? Must have lost him, too. Or I think the phone line is pretty bad there. A Facebook question from Larry. Do you guys know about Wes Jackson's work with the Land Institute in Kansas?
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
If so, could you comment on how their efforts compare or contrast with efforts here to breed prairie species for commercial crops?
Yeah,
go ahead.
So Wes Jackson at the Land Institute in Kansas has been doing work for many years that has a lot of parallels in terms of what we're trying to do with biofuel crops, except he's been really working on, you know, crops that we can use for food. So exactly the same types of issues. And we, you know, our agricultural landscape at this point in time is largely a monoculture and largely composed of annuals. And he and his team have really been saying, can we look at some fundamentally different structures for our agricultural system? Can we come up with perennial equivalents for wheat, for corn, et cetera? And then maybe even a little bit more audacious, but I think really critical, is the question of can we even plant those different types of species together to get that diversity and still be able to grow the food that we need to feed people. So it's a very long-term project that that they're embarked on, but very fascinating and really parallels a lot of what we're looking at for energy, for fuel.
So you've kind of probably gained a little bit of knowledge from their work then.
Yeah.
Yeah, we certainly struggle with the same, not the same, but similar trade-offs of trying to think about ways that we can perennialize the system and improve kind of the environmental quality in rural landscapes. But at the same time, we still have a lot of food that we need to produce, you know, to feed people. And in our case, you know, we want to be as productive as possible in terms of making biomass for energy.
Yeah.
So it's a serious problem, and that trade-off is one of the big challenges. Yeah. That we face right now.
Conundrums, yeah.
Yeah, another layer that, you know, that we've talked about in the past on the air, Larry, is kind of that fuel versus fuel debate. And this is, once again, you know, how do we make sure that we're cognizant of best practices for food production, and we don't want to disturb that, but at the same time working, for example, on, we haven't talked about marginal lands, these places where we really can't be growing food crops, and that's where we would focus at least, you know, a significant portion of this production in terms of dedicated biofuel crops.
Yeah. If there's so much research going on, I know we have a website, and we don't talk about the website very much, so let's mention that.
Right. GLBRC.org has a wide diversity of information. You can get lots of detail on the research. There's information there for the general public. There's also information on education programs.
And the energy, you've got a grand opening of, in 20 seconds, can you tell us
about it? Thank you, Larry, very much. Yeah, bottom line, next week, Friday and Saturday, April 5th and 6th, here on campus, we're opening this wonderful new building, the Wisconsin Energy Institute, a whole collaboration, once again, from disciplines across the spectrum. To get details, I would really encourage you to go to energy.wisc.edu. There's a great schedule lineup for everybody.
And we'll talk about that on another show as well. Thank you both very much for being with us, and thanks for listening. Stick around.
How would you like to fly away with free airline tickets? Enter the WPR Spring Sweepstakes, and you could do just that. Visit friends, family, or go someplace new. Entering the sweepstakes is easy. Just make a donation right now at WPR.org. Sustaining members are automatically entered. Go to WPR.org to find out all the details and prizes. You can't win if you don't enter, so enter today, and good luck.
Support for WPR comes from Paradigm Gardens, featuring hydroponic growing supplies that offers the option of year-round fresh produce grown in containers. More at ParadigmGardens.com, a proud supporter of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support also comes from Buttonwood Partners Incorporated of Madison, providing investment advice and retirement planning services since 1990. Information on the web at buttonwoodpartnersinc.com or 800-279-7000.